So John 10 is going to start with the parable of the good shepherd. And we talked about this just at the very end of last week's study. But John 9, I think there's no real transition between John 9 and John 10. It's just like Jesus keeps talking. And if we miss the connection here, I think it's easy to miss some of the points that Jesus makes in John 10. So just a reminder, in John 9, you have the story of the blind man. And one of my favorite chapters, would you mind grabbing that? And then, thanks, Amy. In John 9, just some really funny things. I love the blind man and kind of his response to things. And it's just some really funny things in John 9. But if you guys remember, the Pharisees have just been after Jesus, and that has just been increasing and growing. Things have been getting more confrontational between Jesus and the Pharisees, and they want Jesus gone. They're just after him. And so in John 9, they, of course, are totally blind to the miracle that Jesus has done. They don't care that there's a blind man who's been healed. They're mad that Jesus did it on Sabbath day, for one thing. And they're mad that Jesus is using this to kind of make himself out to be God. And of course, that's a big thing. So like this no small claim. We'll talk more about that tonight. But in John 9, you remember the basic story, like Jesus heals this guy, puts some mud on his eyes, becomes back seeing, and then the Pharisees are like, "Who healed you?" And he's like, "Jesus." And they're like, "Well, like he's a sinner." And he's like, "Well, healed me. Like, how is that so?" And then they like go to the guy's parents. And you remember what his parents do when they're like, "Is this your son? Was he born blind?" Because like they don't believe the miracle. What do the parents say?
That's Kim.
Yeah, he's our son. And yes, he was born blind, but how he now sees, we don't know. He's of age, ask him. They just throw him under the bus. John records for us, they did this because they were scared of the Pharisees, because they were going to cast anyone out of the synagogue who said they believed in Jesus, that he was the Christ. And so keep that in mind for tonight. And then they come back to the blind man, like, "Give glory to God. To God, we know this man's a sinner." And he's like, "Listen, whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I know, though I was blind, now I see." And he's like, "You keep asking me, do you also want to be his disciples?" You know, there's just these funny kind of back and forth. But they do cast out the blind man at the end. They cast him out, and Jesus comes and finds him. And I appreciate that. Jesus found him beginning and then finds him again, just like the man in John 5 at the pool. And he says, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He said, "Well, who is he?" "I am. I'm the one standing here," and he worships him. And then, so notice at the very end of this, in verse 40, John 9, verse 40, some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains." And again, I think this is the same conversation, just goes right into, "Truly, truly, I say to you, he does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way. This man is a thief and a robber." So he's going to shift analogies here. We've been using light and dark, like Jesus saying, "I am the light of the world," and he heals a blind man. He's going to shift to a shepherding analogy now, but keep the blind man story fresh in your mind as you read this. So let's read. And April, would you mind starting us off reading verses 1 through 6, John 10, verses 1 through 6?
"Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him. For they do not know the voice of strangers. This figure of speech Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying."
So I want us to think for just a minute about the different parts of this parable. So I do think this is a parable that Jesus is telling, and there's lots of points that he makes in the parable. But who are the main characters in the parable as Jesus tells this story about a shepherd?
Sheep.
Okay, so there's the sheep, and they hear the voice of the shepherd. They know his voice, follow him. Who are some of the other characters? Yep, the shepherd, right? Very good. Who else?
Gatekeeper.
Okay, there's a gatekeeper as well. I haven't really thought about that one, but that's true. There's verse 3.
The thief that comes in over the wall or something.
Mm-hmm, that's right. So there's a thief coming in to steal the sheep. He's not the shepherd. And also in verse 5, who else?
Stranger.
The stranger. And so there's lots of different characters in this parable. It's very interesting thinking about kind of what's going on here. We'll see a little bit more of this clearly in a minute, but let's go ahead and identify who we can identify in this parable, thinking about John 9. Who's the shepherd?
Jesus.
Very good. So in just a minute, he will say, I am the good shepherd. Now, what's interesting is he is going to identify himself as a couple of different roles in this parable, which is kind of interesting in just a minute. So he's the shepherd. Very good. Who else can you identify in the parable here?
Robber, Pharisees.
Yeah, the Pharisees are the thief. And who else might the Pharisees be as well?
The stranger.
Yeah, the stranger who's trying to get the sheep to follow them. They're speaking like a shepherd, but the sheep hears them as like, that's not my shepherd. I'm not following that stranger. I don't know their voice. And so they might be kind of the thief, also kind of the voice trying to mislead the sheep. So who would be the sheep in this case?
Us.
Yeah, us. And in John 9, who would the sheep be?
The blind man.
Yeah, the blind man, I think, is in part the sheep here. So we will talk some more about this in a minute, because Jesus is going to get a little more specific, I think, when they retell. So he starts out with this parable. And notice in verse 6, what's the reaction? They didn't understand. And this has been like the whole Gospel of John, right? It's like Jesus will say something and they don't understand what he's talking about. They're like, hey, Jesus, what? Why are you talking about a shepherd? Like, what's going on? So he's going to make some things very clear for them. He's not going to explain every step, but make some things very clear. So let's keep reading. Layla, would you mind reading verses 7 down through verse... let's just go ahead and read down through verse 21.
Okay. Then Jesus said to them again, most assuredly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All whoever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief does not come except to steal and to kill and to destroy. I have come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But a hireling who is not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he is a hireling and does not care about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my sheep, for I am known by my own. As the Father knows me, even so I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I will bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. Therefore my Father loves me, because I lay down my life, that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This command I have received from my Father. Therefore, there was a division against again among
the Jews because of these things. And many of them said, has he a demon? He has a demon and is mad. Why do you listen to him? Others said, these are not the words of those of one who has a demon. Can a demon open up the eyes of the blind?
Okay. Thanks, Layla. So after they don't understand the initial parable, Jesus comes right out, and there's going to be two different I am statements in this chapter. We've been tracking these I am statements of Jesus so far. There have been two so far. Do y'all remember either of the two that Jesus has said so far in John?
The world.
I'm the light of the world. That's right. He's actually said that one twice already. He said it in chapter 8, verse 12, and he said it again in chapter 9 before he healed the blind man, chapter 9, verse 5. So he said that one twice. There was another I am statement that was connected to another miracle that he did earlier.
Was it? Oh, earlier.
Mm-hmm. I am the bread.
I am the bread of life. And that is back in John chapter 6, verse 35. I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst. And so those have been the direct I am statements. Now, Jesus also talked to the woman at the well about giving her living water. He did not say, I am living water, although I think that's also true. But we're just looking at the I am statement. So I am statement number 3 in the book of John is verse 7. What is this I am statement? John 10, verse 7.
Door.
I'm the door of the sheep. I feel like this one gets maybe underplayed in like the list of I am statements, because we remember I am the good shepherd a lot, but I am the door of the sheep is actually what he says right before saying I am the good shepherd.
There's the door.
Okay, so it's funny. Right, so we have that song, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. It's interesting to me that the author of that song, he didn't use all of the I am statements. He didn't use I am the shepherd. He didn't use I'm the door, which is kind of interesting. But that's the one that Jesus uses first in this analogy. And this might go back actually to the gatekeeper. Dan mentioned the gatekeeper earlier back in verse 3. I am the door of the sheep. And what is the significance that Jesus puts on him being the door of the sheep?
Salvation can only be achieved by going through him.
Yeah. Jesus is going to say something very similar. Another of his I am statements later in John, maybe more famous one. What does he say later in John? I am the
shepherd.
Let's say the good shepherd in this chapter. That's exactly right. But in, later in John, I am the
way.
Way. Very similar to saying I am the door. And when he says I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me. So when he says, I am the way, it's very similar to saying, I am the door. So there's no other way in or out except through Jesus. That's it. And so that's the point here, is he's saying, I am the door of the sheep. Now he points out there's people who are trying to get to the sheep other ways. They're trying to climb over the wall or whatever. He said, that's a thief and a robber. The sheep aren't listening to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundant. There's another famous saying of Jesus in the midst of this parable. He's here for the life of the sheep. A good shepherd makes it to where the sheep can thrive. We go back to Psalm 23 here, right? The Lord is my shepherd. He leads me beside still pastures. He leads me in green pastures beside the still waters. He restores my soul. There's all these beautiful word pictures that the Bible is full of that have to do with God being our shepherd. He wants to take care of the sheep. Now, there's a lot of other people who don't have the sheep's best interest in mind. They're here to steal, to kill, to destroy. And you've already seen that in John chapter 9. What were the Pharisees trying to do?
Well, they didn't throw stones, right? Those were like some people listening, right?
Well, they picked up stones at some point to do at one point, and we're going to see them do that in this chapter, okay. Actually. So it's coming. They want Jesus dead. So they're seeking to kill him. That's a big thing. What else?
They're throwing people out of the synagogue who didn't get in line with what they were teaching, even if it was clearly a miracle.
That's right. They're ignoring the miracle, but they're using their socio-religious power to throw people out of the synagogue. because they want to control who people are believing in and who's getting influence. And so
they remind me of the prophesized false prophets.
Yeah, almost. That's right.
Yeah,
very much that they're wanting to draw the sheep away after themselves, and they're false. So the good shepherd is taking care of the sheep. The Pharisees, they don't care that a blind man's been healed. They don't care that, like, you know, the lame man who was healed on the Sabbath. They don't care. They're not seeing the good shepherd taking care of the sheep. They just see their own little rules being broken, and that's all they can think about. And so they're just about stealing and killing and destroying. And so you see the parallel there. So what is the next I am statement, verse 11?
I am a good shepherd.
I am the good shepherd. So he points out not every shepherd is good, but he's a good shepherd. And what does he point out about the good shepherd? That's the first thing he says.
Sounds like the sheep.
He lays down his life for the sheep. And I want you to just think about that for just a minute. In a real sense, whose life is more valuable? The shepherd or the sheep?
Shepherd.
The shepherd's life is, in a real sense, more valuable. Now, I realize this is not going to be a perfect analogy with everything here, but it's the analogy Jesus uses. I mean, you think about it. If you're watching a bunch of sheep out in the field, and there is a wolf, and he's hungry, what are you going to probably do before you get eaten by the wolf? You're going to fight, maybe try to fend him off.
Sheep get eaten.
And then be like, you know what? If you're that hungry, like, I'd rather you have a couple of sheep. I'll try to take the rest and run. Or if it comes to it, I'm getting out of here. And like, okay, well, you can have some sheep. At some point, you'll be full and you'll leave. But like, I'm not going to lay down my life for the sheep. Like, it's the sheep, you know? Like, it's valuable, but like, it's not me, you know? And so that's just a very natural way for us to think. And he says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. That's just a really powerful thing to say.
So going through Hebrews, I keep giving him credit for this because I was confused by it, but the distinction between Moses and Jesus as made Hebrews that Moses was in God's house, you know, tending to the house, where Jesus was over God's house, tending to the house. So it's not like there's going to be a sacrificial sheep where he's going to be like, nah, you guys run, I'm going to protect you. Sheep's going to get mauled. Mm-hmm. It's the shepherd who has authority over the sheep and has the power to protect the sheep that lays down his life for the sheep. That's right. And he's the only person who can do that.
That's right. And this is just a great model of biblical headship, because sometimes people think, I'm the shepherd. That means I get to boss the sheep around. And it is true that the shepherd has authority over the sheep. One of the points that Jesus makes about the sheep, what's the relationship to the voice of the shepherd? They follow him. They listen and they follow. So if you are the shepherd, you should be able to say what needs to happen, and the sheep should listen and they should follow. That's part of a shepherd-sheep relationship. The other part of the shepherd-sheep relationship is when push comes to shove, the shepherd says, I'll die before the sheep die. And that's just a very different model of leadership than the world has, than we often really think about it when it comes down to it. This is a very challenging teaching that Jesus is giving about shepherding, that really truly the good shepherd lays down his life for a sheep. And this should be true in any kind of headship relationship, whether it's a husband-wife relationship, parents and children. And we see it, I guess, probably most clearly with like parents and children, where it's like somebody comes in my house, like I'm the first one going down. If I have anything to do with it, like if they're coming here to take life, they got to go through me to get to my family. And so that is like, I will lay down my life for my family. But then with like shepherd and sheep, we're like, oh, like that's a little different. You know, like this is like my property. This isn't like another person. But of course, Jesus, where's he going with all this? We're the sheep. It's his people. And so that's, I think, part of what's behind this analogy is that it's not just about animals. It is about human souls. And that's what he's getting at here. He's the good shepherd, and he is going to lay down his life for his sheep. I want you to look at verse 12 for a minute. We come back to the hired hand. He didn't really mention the hired hand before. Oh, sorry, Matt. Go ahead.
Just real quick. I'm forgetting where it is, but doesn't it kind of line up with he has no greater strength than those who lays down his life for his friends?
Yes.
That's simply the same thing.
That's exactly right. And that's in the Gospel of John. It's going to be a little bit later in a different conversation. Jesus will say in John 15, verse 13, John 15, 13, greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. And actually, you see both ends of the shepherd-sheep relationship there, don't you? You see, I will lay down my life for you. And you see, you're my friends if you do what I command you, if you listen to the voice of the shepherd and follow his voice. So that's kind of interesting. You got both of those there. So thanks for making that connection.
Yeah, I'll ask that in a different way.
Yeah, go ahead, Deanne.
Okay, so it's as far as laying down your life, couldn't it also be applied as putting all else aside to step in and fight for the justice of those injusticed? Because you're laying down your life by putting all energy to fulfill God's purpose for helping the weak and the lowly.
So on the point of just laying down your life does not always mean you die. Laying down your life does mean that, like, you're giving your energy, your time, yourself to some thing or someone. I do think that's right, is that, like, if you say, oh, well, I would die for this person, but you're not, like, helping them out daily, well, what's the good of that? You know, like, you give the final sacrifice for them, but you're not, like, helping them with the daily things they need. Like, that doesn't really work out. So laying down your life, the shepherd is not just, like, well, I'll let the sheep kind of starve, but if the wolf comes, I'm going to, you know, throw myself in the way. That's not the point. He's nourishing and cherishing the sheep. He's, like, taking care of them. And the Bible does talk a lot about taking care of the poor, those who are disenfranchised, those who are marginalized, who are outcast. And we're going to see some of that here with John 9, with Jesus, the guy who goes and finds the blind man after he was cast out. Now, I do think I want to be very careful how I phrase this. It's possible for us to get focused on a type of serving the poor that can become, I don't know if that's the right way to say it. It's like, it can become almost purely social. It can become almost purely like, I just want to be a good person and, like, help people. And if we ever lose sight of spiritually serving people, because this is one of those things where, like, people often go to one extreme or the other and say, like, well, we need to help the poor and the marginalized, and the way to do that is to make sure they have food in their belly and a roof over their head. That's absolutely what people need at times. But if we feed and clothe people and we do not give them the gospel, they might be fed and clothed lost people. And what does it do? What good does it do for a person to gain the whole world and lose their soul? Jesus teaches very clearly about that. However, Jesus also says, why do you say, you know, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, and you don't take care of somebody, you know, like, you don't give him what's needful for the body? Well, that's not any really good either. That, like, man's drowning and you're like, oh, here's a tract, you should read, you know, like, read this. And, like, sorry, you might need a life preserver, but, you know, oh well. No, like, and of course that's an extreme analogy, but you get the idea that, like, people have physical needs. And so Jesus laying down his life for us did not mean there were never going to be poor or hungry or lonely or sick people ever again. That's not what Jesus came to do. He came to provide spiritual life for people. Now, in the process, he healed the lame. He gave sight to the blind man. He made him able to be part of society again. Now, the Pharisees didn't want that, so they cast him out of the synagogue, and so there's all of that. So I think we live in a complicated world right now where spiritual and social issues are intertwined, and we have to tread carefully with how we don't exclude part of it to focus on another part of it. So does that make sense? That's a good question, Deanne. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Thoughts or comments on all that dimension of this? So, go ahead.
Your comment earlier just made me think, like you said, almost as like a funny example of like, you know, if you were to not, if you were say you lay your life down for someone and not attend to their daily needs, like how silly is that to even say you'd lay your life down for someone you wouldn't take care of? But just like, how often do we actually do that? Like, you see parents that like, yeah, I'd fight anyone that like went after my daughter, whatever, but like, they left their daughter's emotional needs or their well-being or their day-to-day existence, or like friends that like, yeah, they're my sister, I'd do anything for them, but like when they need something, you're gone. And just like, it's hard to be there every day. Like, it's easier in some ways to give your life than to do the daily giving of your life.
Yeah, that's right. So as we think about part of that same point, look at verse 12, and we got the hired hand. He's a hired hand, is not a shepherd, does not own the sheep. They see the wolf coming, and what do they do? They're out. And who in the previous chapter in the blind man's story kind of fits this description? I think it's his parents. And this is what's so crazy to me. As you think about this for just a second, this is the parents. You talk about parents, saying that. I mean, this is, goes with what you just said. A hired hand who does not own the sheep. I mean, who should own, not really own, but like, who should be closer to a child than their parents? And yet, the parents of this particular blind man are so afraid of the social and maybe even religious consequences of being cast out of the synagogue that they see the wolf coming and they run. That I think that's the analogy Jesus used. They saw the trouble coming, and they could have stood up for their son and said, yeah, of course he's the Christ. Like, look at what he did for my son. Like, this is amazing. This is wonderful. And I don't care what power you have. You don't have the power that this guy had to open the eyes of my child. And yet, because of their fear, they're not acting as a shepherd of the child. They're acting like a hired hand. And they cut and run when they see the wolf come. And this just tells us, among other things, about the power of relationships, and that the parents are so scared of what could happen with getting cast out of the synagogue and their relationship to their other people in their life, I guess, that they're willing to throw their own child under the bus, so to speak, to do this. And so we just need to let that sink into our own hearts, because it's like, well, what social consequences would it take for me to cut and run? You know, like, I need to be willing to stand with Jesus and those who are with Jesus, even if it means being rejected by the people dearest to me in my life.
I think I have seen examples of parents who, in a similar way, they'll be embarrassed of their kid because they make them look bad, or, you know, they're like, why don't you be more like this normal kid over there? It doesn't show that same love, that where, you know, God's extremely accepting. And for a child to not see that reflected in their parents, see, oh, they're only going to love me or care for me if I either make them look good or help them fit in. It's just not a good message to send your kids.
I was also just thinking about, like, for the blind man, or for anybody who has had the hurt of that type of broken relationship, though, to see, like, the shepherd is there,
yes,
and loves more than any relationship that should have been better.
Yes.
That even if that has been neglected or broken, that the shepherd is there and really does love.
Amen.
Yeah, I think that's what the parents are missing, because like Jesus says, ask and you shall receive. And these guys never asked, because if they had asked and they saw their son with eyes, they would have been like, God answered our prayers. So they must not have been asking.
Yeah.
They must have given up and been like, oh, the doctor said he's going to be like this. You know, those people who kind of just get cut and they get in those ruts and then they believe everything the earth tells them and whatever they see.
Yeah. It raises all kinds of questions about the parents in this situation. Right. It's like, man, like what kind of, what was, but again, how do we do the same thing? You know, it's so easy for us to rag on the parents in this chapter. And yet when we put ourselves really, when we think about getting cast out of the synagogue and what that would mean, would we do the same thing is the question. Psalm 27, verse 10, Psalm David, he says, for my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in. I think that's just a powerful thing. David wrote about the Lord being his shepherd and the Lord also being even more faithful than his father and mother. So that is exactly right. And at the end of John 9, that's exactly what we see. The parents are nowhere to be found with their son, but Jesus finds him and takes him in. And that's, I think, going to be the kind of one of the points of this chapter is Jesus takes in the people that even the religious establishment and even his own parents cast out.
Just one thought on that. I don't think this is the chapter that talks about like going after the one lost sheep versus the 99, but similar like context about the shepherd and the sheep and like leaving the sheep to go find the one that's lost. And the idea of like in that parent relationship, if your child goes astray, like these people, they felt like their child was maybe going astray in a different way. And they're like, all right, I'm out. Like you go astray and you do your thing. And I've seen parents do that with their kids where their kids start to question their faith and the parents like, I'm done with you. You've messed up. Like, don't talk to me. Like we're done. And like, how far would Jesus go to get that child back? And the parent, because they are going to look bad at their church when their kids stop showing up, they're done. It's just, it's mind-boggling.
So Jesus is the good shepherd. He's not just going to let the sheep go. He's going to look for the sheep, the one sheep. Now, I will say, Jesus does not force the sheep to come back. The sheep has to listen to his voice and follow him. And that's another part of this chapter. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. But I want to just note here that Jesus does broaden the picture here a little bit, because I do think that like Jesus is teaching about what's happening in John 9 and saying, here's what's happening spiritually right now. Do you guys see what's going on with the blind man and the Pharisees and me and the parents? This is what it looks like to God. It's like the good shepherd situation and the hired hand and the thief and the robber. This is what's going on. But he says something that kind of expands the analogy a little bit in verse 16. He talks about other sheep that are not of this fold, and he's going to bring them in also. I'll just open it up real quick. I think there's some other passages that will shed some light on this, but who do you think the other sheep are that Jesus is talking about here?
Peter, Paul,
okay, what was that?
Gentiles.
I think ultimately it's going to be the Gentiles. So again, roll with me here. Look over at John chapter 11, verse 52. This is after Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead. And there is the unwitting prophecy that Caiaphas, the high priest, makes. But in verse John 11, verse 50, we'll start in verse 50. He says, verse 51, it says, he did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. And so it seems a little more clear in this context that he's talking about there's a nation that's kind of the sheep, and then there's those who are scattered abroad, which would be the Gentiles. And so that seems to be the case in this very next chapter. And so I think that's the other sheep he's talking about, is there's the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And then there's the Gentiles who will come in later, and there'll be one flock, one shepherd. So that's like a whole nother conversation. Like that's a much bigger than the blind man situation. But that's where the shepherd sheep thing is going, is there's going to be a much bigger picture of the shepherd to the sheep and all of these things. Does that make sense, Thomas?
When God told Paul, I think it was to go to Corinth, and he said, because I have many people in that city, but it seems like they were like not saved yet, but like he knew who was his and who would listen. Is that parallel at all? Because I guess not, there would have been Gentiles. I can't figure out how to ask this. But like, is this talking about like Gentiles who are currently serving him, or like Gentiles who will be saved? I guess is that.
I take it in the sense of Gentiles who will be saved, that God knows who are his own, and they will come to him when they hear the voice of the good shepherd. And that is a future thing that's going to happen at this point. Okay. So he points out at the end of this that Jesus is going to lay down his life. And he's going to add a little nuance here, because he's already talked about the good shepherd lays down his life. He points out in verse 18, what's the situation that's not actually happening? Verse 18. When Jesus lays down his life, what's not going on?
They're not believing.
He doesn't earn it.
Yeah, it says, no one takes it from me. So there are situations where someone is not really ready to lay down their life, but they die because their life was taken from them. When Jesus goes to the cross, it would have been easy to think, oh, well, they finally got him. They've been trying to kill him this whole time, and he couldn't get away that time. You know, he's escaped this time, he escaped that time, and well, they got him, and they took his life from him. And Jesus is saying, when I die, make no mistake, they're not taking my life from me. I am laying it down. Now, that does not make the people who killed him not guilty. They weren't thinking of it in those terms. But Jesus gave himself up to them. Jesus, we've seen already that like there's multiple times where he kind of apparently miraculously just like passed through the midst of them and was gone. Like, if he just wants to escape, you're not going to capture him. Like, there's no human on earth that could capture Jesus, no army on earth that could subdue him if he wants to escape. And so Jesus makes this clear in John. He says, nobody takes my life from me. I lay it down. I have authority to lay it down. And what else does he point out? I have authority to take it up again. I'm going to give my life, and I'm going to rise from the dead. Jesus is in the driver's seat the whole time, even when it looks like everything has gone wrong and now he's dead. And it looks like evil has won. And Jesus is saying, it's going to look that way, but that's not the case. I'm in the driver's seat the whole time. And when I die, I'm laying down my life for the sheep. That's what's really going on here. Even if it feels like they've murdered the good shepherd, and they have, that's not the whole picture. So I think that's really helpful. And by the way, we're going to see that in John 18. I think this is really interesting. John's the one who records little extra detail. You'll remember this. So like, they come to Jesus in the garden. They got torches. They got, you know, clubs, they're ready to subdue him physically. And Jesus tells Peter to put away his sword. And they're like, he says, who are you seeking? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus says, I am he. And do you remember what happens in John 18 when Jesus said, I am? There's an extra detail in it I think is really interesting.
They fall down or something?
They fall on the ground. So we'll read this in a minute. This is John 18, verse 6, where this is recorded. I wonder if there's not a little bit of that going on here, that like it's perfectly clear, even in a moment of arrest when they get Jesus, that when they show up and they're like, who are you looking for? And they're like, Jesus of Nazareth. And he's like, I am. Boom. They like fall down on the ground. And it's almost like Jesus is playing with them. Like, and he asks them again, who are you seeking? And they're like, Jesus of Nazareth. And they're like, I told you that I am. And then they capture him. But it's almost like he's just showing, listen, at any moment in all of this, I could say the word and you would be gone. It's a little bit like if you ever watched like a grown man wrestle with their child, and And a couple of points in the wrestling match, they might just say, like, you know, it's like, oh, you got me. And they're like, okay, you got me. You know, like that's what's going on with Jesus, is like, he is just letting them do this to him. And it's not in any way because they've outsmarted him or overpowered him or any of those things. And so I view that, like, the I am statement there in the garden when they arrest Jesus as a little bit of that reminder, like, you're doing this, but it is only because I'm laying myself down to do that. So I think that goes back to this. No one takes it from me. I lay it down in my own accord. So John records both of those things. That's interesting. Okay. Wow. We are already done 15 minutes. Thoughts or comments on this? So at the end of this, and again, I think this is actually the end of a really long section of John. This started back in chapter 7 when we started talking about the Feast of Booths or Feast of Shelters. Chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9 now, the first part of chapter 10, all been this big trip to Jerusalem. And there's one more time, a division among the Jews. And what are some people saying about Jesus? What's the accusation? Verse 20. He's a demon. He's crazy. Why listen to this guy? And then again, this is like the blind man. Other people are recognizing what? Verse 21.
Did a demon take characters?
Yeah. So two things, actually. One is miracles. And two, these are not the words of one who is oppressed by a demon. And those have been the two things that have been standing out about Jesus. No one ever spoke like this man. And when the Christ comes, will he do more signs than this man has done? And so, like, the words and the works are both, people are like, there's no way this man has a demon. Demon-possessed people don't speak like that, and demons can't heal blind people. Like, that does not make any sense. So that's very sound reasoning. But again, even though there's miracles right in front of them, there are people who are blind. They're not seeing what's going on. I don't know about you, but there are sometimes, especially when I was younger, man, I just really wish I could have lived at a time and, like, seen Jesus and seen the miracles that he did. And, like, I just wouldn't struggle in my faith and I wouldn't have any more questions. It would just be so obvious and so clear that there'd be no unbelief. It's like, look at what happened when Jesus was actually here. That did not just clear it up for everybody. Like, we can wish that. And of course, none of us get to go back and say, I want to choose to live in that time. But people were still people. And people still found ways of rationalizing their unbelief when there were true miracles happening right in front of them. And so it's wishful thinking sometimes, but when we wish that, we should just go look at what people did who actually lived in those times. And there were still people who found reasons not to believe. So I just think that's interesting.
I remember a conversation I had with someone from school. So I was always known as, like, the good Christian boy, you know, amongst my peers. It was just like, you know, I really just wish, he's like, it's like, I want to believe in God, but I really just wish he would just kind of, like, just come down from heaven and just tell me that he exists, you know? It's like, then I believe, like, and it is a good reminder to see examples of that kind of stuff in scripture, where it's like, where it's easy to get caught up in that. Why doesn't God come down and show us that he exists? Like, well, he has done that, and people still didn't believe. So that's no excuse. We should get discouraged by that.
Yeah, he did come down.
Yeah.
His name is Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So John, it's really interesting to me as kind of a side note that John is really a book about evidences in a lot of ways, that this is a book of eyewitness testimony of people who are saying, I saw this. I was there. This is what happened. And even then, people aren't believing. And there are some people who, it does not matter what evidence you show them, it does not matter what questions you answer, if they don't want to believe, that doesn't make them believe. And I think that's another evidence in John is we're going to see that Jesus gives people every opportunity to believe in him. But he ultimately gives us a choice. And he allows us to choose whether to believe in him and trust him and follow him, to listen to his voice, or he allows us to walk away. And that's an amazing thing. But that is what he allows us to do. All right, we only have like 9 minutes left. We do not have enough time to finish the chapter, but here's what I want to do is we're going to talk about the context of this last part of the chapter, because it's kind of its own little unit here. It's an interesting section. It's about the Feast of Dedication, which is what we call Hanukkah. And that's also interesting in and of itself that this is in the Bible. But there's a little bit of connection to the sheep conversation that I want to cover while we're talking about John 10 and John 9. So I want to read the first part of this just to catch the sheep shepherd part of this. But this is like we're skipping ahead here. Jesus has been in Jerusalem for the Feast of Booths, and now we're like in winter time. This is a different time frame, not the same conversation. But he's going to bring up some stuff that's very, very similar. So let's read verse 22. It says, at that time, the Feast of Dedication took place at Jerusalem. It was winter. And Jesus was walking in the temple in the Colonnade of Solomon. So the Jews gathered around him and said to him, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. Jesus answered them, I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name bear witness about me. But you do not believe because you are not among my sheep. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they will never perish, and no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one. And the whole rest of this conversation is going to zero in on that last statement, I and the Father are one. But I want to zero in for just a minute on the shepherd sheep thing, because Jesus just added a couple of things here to that analogy. And what do you see here? What do you notice about the sheep in verse 27? How do you be a good sheep?
Listen.
You gotta listen.
Yeah,
that's like rule number one of being a good sheep is like listen to the voice of the shepherd.
What's that like? I just said know his voice.
Yeah, know his voice. Don't just listen to anybody, but listen to the voice of the shepherd. And what else?
I was just gonna say listen to hear though.
Yeah, listen to hear. That's right.
Follow.
And follow. Don't just hear the voice, but start walking. You know, move. Do something in the right direction. And so that's really who Jesus shows. These are my sheep. My sheep are the ones who hear my voice. And I know them. And they follow me. That's who Jesus' sheep are. And there's going to be other sheep who don't listen. Or they listen and they don't follow. And that's not who Jesus is going to take care of. It's the sheep who are his that he takes care of. Now, I want you to notice, what does he add in verse 28 and 29 about the opposition? What can the people, what can the sheep stealers not ultimately do?
Snatch them out of his hand.
Yeah, no one can snatch them out of his hand. No one. If Jesus has you and you are listening to his voice and you are following him, nobody can come in and just say, nope, sorry, good shepherd, that one's mine. And I've climbed up the back wall and I snatched it and got it. Jesus says, no one can snatch him out of my hand. And no one can snatch him out of the Father's hand, for that matter, verse 29. My Father's greater than all. Like, nobody can snatch him out of the Father's hand. So I want you to back up to John 9 one more time. I realize we're on to a different context. But what were the Pharisees doing to try to snatch sheep in John 9?
Blasphemy.
Yeah, saying that Jesus was blaspheming.
Intimidation.
And intimidating. They're trying to cast people out of the synagogue and keep them from going to Jesus. Here's the thing. They cast the blind man out. But was the blind man cast out from God? No. And I think that's part of the point here, is that he would have felt cast out from God. Because all the religious people who say they love God and serve him, they're all there in the synagogue, and I can't go worship with them anymore. I'm cast out of the synagogue. But Jesus is saying, listen, the religious establishment might throw you out, and they might bar you from coming back in, but they did not snatch you out of my hand. They did not snatch you out of the Father's hand. I know my own, and my own know me. And it doesn't matter what they say about you. It doesn't matter if they cast you out and make fun of you and say you're a sinner. If I know you and you know my voice, I've got you. And no one can snatch you out of my hands. No matter how powerful or influential or religious they might look, no one can snatch you out of my hand. I think that's really the point of this. And so I think that's really powerful. We see that with John 9. That, like, that's kind of why Jesus is saying this. Now, this gets into a much bigger kind of theological debate, because a lot of times these verses come up and we're talking about teachings like once saved, always saved. Like, can someone fall from grace and